Resource Committee to order. Today's Friday, April 28th, 2023. The time is 3:30 PM. Please silence all cell phones. Present today, Co-Chair Geisel, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Dunbar, Senator Willikowski's on the phone, Senator Klayman's on other state business. We'll be attending shortly myself. Senator Bishop, Senator Kaufman is here. Thanks, Carrie Cooperator and Amanda Kraft. It's Friday. We about got her in the bag here today, so we're going to have a nice afternoon here for the rest of the day. And I'd like to recognize Senator Olson from the Nome area, Gullivan's hometown, and we appreciate him being here in the room as well as his staff. So with that, today's first action item on the agenda will be the Cook Inlet review and permit buyback bill. Next, we're going to have Mr. Doug Vincent Lang in part of our invited testimony on Area M, and that will be just today. We have other presenters who will be on following Monday on invited testimony. So, with that being said, SB 82 Cook Inlet New Administrative Area Permit Buyback. The committee had previously set an amendment deadline. No amendments were received. I look to the co-chair, Geisel, for a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill 82, Work Order 33, LS 0409/A-alpha out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, the bill moves from committee. We'll take a brief at ease, sign the bill packet. Okay, we're back on the record, and Senate Resources is having invited testimony on Area M for the next 2 days, today and Monday. We've got the commissioner here, and we're going to let him make his presentation. Members, I'll look to members at the conclusion of each slide for questions. Commissioner, thank you for being here. And with that, you're free to proceed.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today regarding coastal Western Alaska fisheries and the impact that Area M salmon fisheries may have on them. For the record, my name is Doug Vincent Lang, and I'm the commissioner for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Let me begin by saying that the department is deeply concerned about the poor returns of Chinook, summer chum, fall chum, and coho salmon to coastal Western Alaskan systems. The poor returns have resulted in fishery restrictions and closures that impact food security, subsistence, and cultural activities. I have visited the region numerous times over the last several years and listened to the testimony about the impact this is having. The words spoken are heartfelt, and the impact is clearly understood. Let me be clear. We understand and are very sympathetic to the hardship that the restrictions and closures are having for the people living in Western Alaska. As fishing is restricted or closed in rivers, people are asking what is being done in fisheries that intercept fish destined for these rivers. They're asking these mixed stock fisheries to be restricted, or in the case of legislation being discussed today, closed entirely. It's really important to note that nearly all salmon fisheries are mixed stock fisheries. They all harvest to varying degrees stocks of mixed origins. For example, the salmon fisheries that occur in the lower Yukon River are mixed stocks salmon fisheries in that they harvest a range of discrete stocks that occur upriver of the fishery, including some of Canadian origin. It is not until a fishery is truly prosecuted on the spawning bed that it is not a mixed stock fishery. In the case of coastal western Alaskan chum salmon, these fish are intercepted in various mixed stock marine fisheries, including its bycatch and marine trawl fisheries targeting pollock and cod, as well as various directed salmon fisheries, including the South Alaska Peninsula seine and gillnet fisheries. And they basically are intercepted as they move from their rearing areas in the ocean, both in the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea, as they travel along the coastline up into the Yukon, Kuskokwim, and Norton Sound drainages. While there are many similarities, there are also differences in the migratory patterns of Asian versus coastal western Alaskan chum salmon. As can be seen in this slide, both groupings move through passes in the Aleutians chains. Another pointer here. However, the North American chum stock spend more of their time in the eastern Gulf of Alaska, while there is overlap in the central and western Gulf. So the Asian chums typically are more western focused, and the North American stocks typically spend a little bit more time in the Gulf of Alaska or more eastern. It's important to note that coastal western Alaska stocks are harvested in other fisheries, such as the Bristol Bay salmon fishery, as they move through that fishery on their way to the Kuskokwim and Yukon rivers in Norton Sound area. Bristol Bay fisheries harvest on average more than 1.1 million chum salmon during a fishery that targets primarily sockeye salmon. While it's impossible to know how many of these are not of Bristol Bay origin using current genetics technology, it is suspected that at least some are of Kuskokwim and Yukon River drainage. So the question is, what is the acceptable level of intercept in these fisheries when subsistence is restricted or closed? Should all fisheries be closed if they harvest even a single chum salmon that is destined to coastal western Alaska when these fisheries are closed or restricted? To get a handle on these questions, it is important to understand the stock compositions of salmon harvested in these mixed stock fisheries that intercept coastal western Alaskan chum salmon. This will give us an idea of the impact that the harvest may be having. I will not talk about bycatch in this presentation. It is being addressed by the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. Instead, I'll focus on the fisheries that occur along the South Alaska Peninsula, as this is the fishery that was the focus of the recent Board of Fisheries deliberations and actions that resulted in the Senate bill in front of you. In response to the poor returns of chum salmon to coastal western Alaska, the department initiated an evaluation of the genetic compositions of chum salmon harvested in the South Peninsula mixed stock salmon fisheries last year. This is one of numerous mixed stock salmon fisheries that are known to intercept fish of Bering Sea coastal origin. Before I go further, it is important to note that the geographic scope of the South Alaska Peninsula fisheries differs significantly from the Area M fisheries. This is a slide of the Area M fishery. It includes basically everything along the Alaska Peninsula, down along the Aleutian chain, and includes Pribilof District. Area M covers a large geography. Many of these fisheries do not harvest significant numbers of chum of coastal western Alaskan origin. Instead,
Commissioner, I just want to recognize Senator Klayman has joined us. And before you move off of that number six slide on the Area M geography.
I don't know how to go backwards.
Oh, that's fine. We got our slide okay. Back. But I'm curious, you and I had talked about genetics on the phone the other day a little bit, about the Port Moeller genetics, which could you talk to us? Is that even on this in this area?
Yeah, so the Port Moeller line is a genetics line that gives us genetics on sockeye salmon entering into Bristol Bay. We aren't collecting genetics on chum out there. We're collecting genetics right now on sockeye salmon.
So is the Port Moeller genetics testing on the map on Area M, is it, can we even see it on the map there? On page six.
So it goes off of basically where it says the Northern District on this map. It goes north of that line and goes up across until you get to the mainland of Alaska on the other side.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. And I'm going to come back to genetics before you leave.
Yes, no problem. Instead, based on the results of the WASAP study, the main area of harvest of coastal western Alaskan stocks occur along the South Alaska Peninsula. This includes the Unimak, Southwestern, Southeastern, and South Central districts of Area M. It is these districts that I will focus on since they were the focus of the Board of Fisheries deliberations, not the entirety of Area M. Our study was designed to assess whether stock compositions in this fishery change from when we previously evaluated this as part of the WASAP study conducted over a decade ago. So what did we learn? From fish chicken information, we know that 817,279 chum salmon were harvested in the South Peninsula fisheries in 2022. This is 78% of the recent 10-year average. We also know that 544,137 were harvested during June, which from previous WASF studies is known when chum salmon of coastal Western Alaskan origin are harvested in this fishery. For the June fishery, about 58% of the chum salmon that were harvested were of Asian origin, and 18% were of coastal Western Alaskan origin. That is, about 6 out of every 10 chum salmon harvested were of Asian hatchery origin. In contrast, less than 2 out of 10 were of coastal Western Alaskan origin. Coastal Western Alaska represents a grouping of Bristol Bay, Kuskokwim River, Yukon River, and Norton Sound summer chum salmon. Unfortunately, we cannot detect subcategories within this grouping with the current genetic technology available to us.
With that being said, Commissioner, what do we got to do to hone in on that genetic testing?
So right now we have both the NOAA lab and our genetics lab looking at that very question. We have to look at different genetic sequences within the genome to try to find out which sequence gives us better discrimination between those stocks. And it's not for lack of trying. We all are trying to get answers to those questions. It's just that we haven't found the right sequence within the genetics yet.
And Mr. Dunbar, I'll be right with you. I'm going to stay on this genetics for a minute. So is it the department's goal when you're able to isolate this genetics? Are you looking at an implementation, an RAM similar to, you know, can you give me any update? Are you looking to put something out there in RAM where so we can get a better handle on this and maybe, I don't know if you can do it in real time, but.
Yeah, so right now we can distinguish coastal Western Alaskan chum salmon as a category. The question is, I think you're asking is, can we do that real time in the South Peninsula fisheries in terms of helping us better manage that fishery? Or if there was a cap on place for coastal Western Alaskan chum, can we monitor that? The answer is probably yes to the last question. If we know if we were to put a chum salmon cap of coastal Western Alaskan in the area M fishery, we could probably within 4 days of harvest know what the genetic composition of non-Asian versus coastal Western Alaskan chum are. In terms of moving the fleet around, it's probably not as feasible right now because that fleet is fishing out there. They deliver 2 to 3 days after their harvest occurs, and then by then they may have moved. They probably fished several different areas within the South Peninsula fishery, so by the time we got it, it would probably be too late for them to manage. They would be more appropriately being managed on total chum catches for that purpose.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. So I'm sorry, if we could go back in this presentation just a little bit to slide number 9. I'm curious how confident you are in this data. I mean, the data goes all the way back to 1960. It sort of surprises me that we have this level of specificity going back that time. I assume it comes from the processors, perhaps? So
this is fish chicken information.
So how confident are you that this is actually the amount that was harvested each of those years?
Fairly confident, really confident. We have fish chicken information. We're confident in that information.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's just, to me, it's surprisingly good data to go back 50 years. But can you explain a little bit more about what caused this large spike in, looks like 2021?
Yeah, so what happened in 2021 is there were two issues. One was there was confidentiality issues. And when you have less than 3 people reporting to a processor, or you have less than 3 processors, you end up with not being able to release that data until after the season. So we got caught with confidentiality. We also got caught with just a big sockeye return, which was coming back to Bristol Bay in that year. So there was a lot of fishing going on in that district. And as such, we weren't able to, between confidentiality and the big sockeye return, we weren't keeping a track very well on what was happening in that fishery. So after that year, we entered into agreements with the fishing fleet to waive confidentiality. We told them that we wanted to get his harvest down to a more normal level, which is about 500, 550,000 in that fishery. And then we implemented the new genetic study. And with the processors working in their with an agreement we had with them to do test fishing and moving around in the fleet, we brought that harvest down in 1 year from 1.1 million in June to about 550,000 this last year.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Commissioner, while we're on that, I had another note and I didn't ask the question. And you can get back to the committee, but in slide 9 from years 1985 through 2000, what were the returns on the Yukon and Custer claim?
I'll have to get back to you with that.
That'd be an interesting data point. Thank you.
Bill, let's go back. So for the June fishery, about 58% of the chum salmon harvested were of Asian origin, and about 18% were coastal Western Alaskan origin. Again, that is to say 6 out of 10 were harvested were of Asian origin, and only 2 out of 10 were of coastal Western Alaskan origin. This slide shows a comparison between the results of our study and the WASAP study that was conducted over a decade ago. What's amazing is that they're pretty similar in terms of what we found. So we verified one thing. We verified that what we were seeing in the WASAP study over a decade ago is kind of similar. The main difference is that you see there is many more Asian chums that are showing up in the June fishery in 2022 than there were in the 2007 through 2009 period, and that the composition in 2022 of coastal Western Alaska stocks went down. So the other thing you can see in the bottom panel of this graph is that really there are very few chums other than South Peninsula local stocks that are harvested after June. So the July fisheries are basically become much more localized chum salmon fisheries than they are in terms of harvesting coastal Western Alaskan stocks. Bottom line, our study showed that about 96,000 summer chum of coastal Western Alaskan harvest were harvested in the South Peninsula fisheries during June last year. Based on preliminary run reconstruction, this represents about a 6% harvest rate on these stocks. Again, this number represents the total number of chum salmon of coastal Western Alaskan origin that were harvested. That is, they are not all of Yukon and Kuskokwim River origin. They are also of Bristol Bay and Norton Sound origin. So this is the information that we presented to the Board of Fisheries at their recent meeting to inform their deliberations and discussions. So the two primary questions that the board faced at their meeting were, what was an acceptable level of intercept, and how could the harvest of coastal Western Alaskan chum salmon be reduced? So let's look at the history, the South Penn fisheries. They have a long and varied history. From the 1960s through the 1970s, fishing periods varied from 4.5 to 7 days per week. From the mid-1970s through the mid-1980s, fishing depended upon the forecasted strength of the Bristol Bay sockeye salmon run. So it wasn't based on chum, it was based on sockeye salmon returning to Bristol Bay. From 1984 to 1986, fishing time was limited to 96 hours per week and no more than 72 consecutive hours to allow for escapement windows.
That's important to show in correlation with slide 9. Of what we had returns on the Yukon and Kuskokwim. So I just want members to remember that.
From 1986 to 2001, the fishery was managed based on Bristol Bay guideline harvest levels and chum salmon caps. From 2004 through 2022, the fishery had set fishing periods with fishing windows. And then we'll get to what happens at the 2003 board meeting.
Okay. And before we do that, when did the seine boats show up on the fishing grounds?
Well, they've been there for a long time.
Can you talk about that? Isn't there bigger boats that showing up?
Or? Oh, yeah. So the seine boat, there has been a seine fishery for a long time, but the seine fishery that occurred 15, 20 years ago was in a much less powerful seine boat than you have right now. A seine boat probably now that's fishing in that fleet is probably twice the size bigger horsepower, pulling more gear through the water. The nets are more efficient at fishing, and they probably have a longer lead. So I'm guessing a same vessel that's fishing in that fishery today is probably 2 to 3 times more powerful per vessel than was fishing 15, 20 years ago in that fishery.
Thank you.
So economically, the South Alaska Peninsula fishery, June salmon fishery, is important to the local area. It has a total ex-vessel value of about $10 million. It raises over $600,000 of fishery business tax, of half of which is shared with local communities, and it raises nearly $100,000 in assessment for the seafood marketing program. I give you that information because we have a fiscal note associated with this bill, and I thought it was important just to lay out what the fiscal note does. It's not to belittle the impact of economically that's occurring in the coastal Western Alaskan systems.
And proposal. I just want to be clear to those listening at home and those on the record, Senate Bill 128 is not in front of us. This is just an informational hearing today on ARAM by the Resource Committee. Thank you.
Proposal 140, which was submitted by the Fairbanks Advisory Committee and supported by TCC and others, called for adoption of a previous management approach that restricted the time fished. Intended to only target South Unimak, Shumagin Islands, June fishery, and not the fisheries in the northern, northwestern, or Unalaska districts of ARAM. They postulated that chum salmon harvest could be reduced solely on reductions of time alone. The proposal reduced current 4 88-hour fishing periods with no more than 3 days in any 7-day period, no more than 16 hours per day, and no more than 2 consecutive 16-hour fishing periods within a 7-day period. On this slide, you can see the current fishing periods that were adopted last year and the proposed fishing periods that would have been adopted under Proposal 140. However, when this management plan was utilized in the early 2000s, it did not significantly reduce the harvest of chum salmon. And given the improved fishing power of the modern purse seine fleet, the department could not guarantee that chum salmon harvest would be reduced based solely on time restrictions. Based on this and other information that the board received at that meeting, the board chose not to pass Proposal 140. It failed on a 3-4 vote. Instead, they adopted a hybrid approach, specifically intended to reduce the harvest of chum salmon in June. This hybrid approach closed an area of known high chum salmon harvest, the Sinek Islands, to commercial salmon fishing during the month of June. This area was the highest area of chum salmon harvest along in that southwestern district that I've shown on the map before. It also reduced commercial salmon fishing time with purse seine gear in June by 13%. It increased the length of closure window during the second week of June, as you can see on this slide. There's a 76-hour now closure between the open 68 hours between the 11th and the 12th, and between the 16th and 17th. And that was basically to provide a passage window for chum salmon through that fishery in the second week of June. Remember, there is no seine fisheries that are occurring in the first week of June, so there's kind of a passage window there. It also created chum salmon harvest triggers that restrict and potentially close the commercial purse seine fishery in June if they are met or exceeded. Remember, we harvested 544,000 chums last year. The trigger of 300,000 chum was set that if exceeded after the second opening would reduce fishing time by 44 hours for the third period. This would provide a passage window in the third week if the 300,000 fish trigger was achieved. A second trigger of 450,000 was set that if exceeded after the third period would close the fourth period in its totality, a reduction of 88 hours. This would establish a passage window in the fourth week as the fishery would be closed. They also expressed an expectation and received a commitment from the fishing industry that if the industry coordinate efforts to reduce chum salmon harvest based on a signed agreement that successfully reduced the chum salmon harvest last year. This included, again, waiving confidentiality and forming voluntary cooperatives. The cooperatives, again, were formed last year and were successful in reducing chum salmon harvest from 1.1 million chum in 2021 to 544,000 chum last year in June. This proposal passed 4-3.
Commissioner, could you have your staff recreate this slide with the closures that you talked about, if the fish were met, you know, with the reduction in hours?
Certainly, we can do that for you.
Thank you.
But basically, if you look at the period from the 18th through the 24th, what they would basically do is lose 44 hours out of that open period in that week. That would create a 72-hour passage window in that week of June. And then if they hit that trigger of 450,000 in the last one, that whole period goes away. So basically, that's just there's no seine fishing occurring during that last week.
Right. That's correct. But I just would like that slide so we can have on our basis for those that are watching from home. You get it and we get it, but it'd be a good visual because you've talked about this closure now in two meetings, and next week we've got some other folks from AREM that are going to be talking about it as well. I think it'd just be a good visual.
Yeah, we'll be happy to provide that.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you mentioned voluntary cooperatives. Can you describe a little bit more what those are and how they work to reduce, if they work to reduce this intercept?
Yeah, so what happened last year is they basically went out, they formed cooperatives, and they went out and test fished with a few of their vessels to find out whether or not they had high chum salmon to sockeye salmon ratios. If they found through that test fishing that they were, they avoided those areas to go fishing. So they basically worked together to avoid areas of high chum salmon to sockeye salmon ratios. And where they found lower ratios, that's where they went and fished during the periods. So it's basically built on the model of a rationalized fishery. In a rationalized fishery, you allow them time and area to fish and try to avoid the bycatch of certain species. But you do that by giving them more area to go fishing in and test fishing so they can move around to avoid chum salmon.
Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair,
please.
So are the cooperatives themselves, are they organized through the department? Are they nonprofits? Are they informal? What's the structure of these cooperatives?
They are formed by the industry themselves. They're not formed by but they've signed an agreement basically with us to operate like they did last year.
Okay. So it's an agreement, but there isn't administrative staff or a formal nonprofit, that kind of thing established.
No, they're doing it on their own, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, please proceed.
Yeah. So I want to note that many people were involved in this outcome, which occurred over a 7-day period during which public comment was taken. The committee, the whole discussion occurred, and numerous after-hour discussions occurred. As with all compromise solutions, people on both sides of the issue were not happy with the outcome. In-river users felt that the board let them down by not adopting their preferred solution to address every salmon counts. South Alaska Peninsula fishermen felt that they lost their traditional rights to harvest and that the board didn't trust the science and support innovative fisheries management to the extent that they could. So I guess at the end of the day, this season will tell the tale of the outcome. If the fishery is prosecuted, we will closely monitor it in season. We will also, assuming a fishery is prosecuted, conduct a second year of genetic sampling. If the fishery is canceled, we will not be able to conduct this study this summer. We have also spoken with public safety to beef up enforcement to address the perceived issue of chum chucking. I spoke with Commissioner Cockrell and talked to him extensively about having enforcement vessels out on this fishing grounds this June, and they've agreed that they will closely monitor for chum chucking this year. Finally, we will monitor the cooperatives to ensure they are operating as agreed to and envisioned. I'm actually considering taking a trip out there for the first week of June and watching the fishery prosecute itself.
Could you notify myself and Co-Chair Giesel, and if you got any space available, maybe myself or some of the other committees would like to go on that trip?
Certainly, we'll let you know. I think the fishermen would appreciate you visiting them out there. So, Senate 128. Oh, we're not talking about Senate Bill 20.
Nope.
So, in closing, as with many Board of Fisheries decisions and also with your legislative process, not everyone is always happy with the outcomes. But in both cases, I can tell you it's not for lack of caring or deliberation. A lot of discussions go on. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
You've answered my first question I had today on the chum chucking and enforcement, and I would ask that maybe if you could have my staff and I, we can reach out to the Department of Public Safety to see the scope and breadth and depth of their enforcement actions out there to eliminate any chum chucking, because for us that would be protein on the river that we could use and on the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. But if you could, can you talk about a little bit about chum retention in the EZ area? So is Area M, looking at your geographical map there, is that an EZ fishery that they have to retain bycatch?
There is some EEZ fishing that occurs along the South Alaska Peninsula outside 3 miles. Right now, the state manages that under delegation from the federal government. So right now, it's managed under state regulations, which has full retention of salmon.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So these, I don't know if you can answer this. So these Asian fish that are processed, they're just sold on the market. They're not required to go to a sea share program or anything like that.
Right now, the processors don't. This fishery is, the South Penn fishery is really a sockeye salmon fishery. They catch chum. They're not targeting chum. Now in the North Peninsula fisheries and some of the other fisheries, as it turns into it, then it becomes a chum fishery for those local stocks of chum. But in the South Alaska Peninsula fishery, they're not after chums, and as a matter of fact, they'd rather catch fewer of them. But they are sold at they are delivered to the processor. The processor is required to deal with them and report them. But right now, my understanding is that the processors have agreed to turn those fish over. They're not buying them. They're turning them over to Sea Share, is what the agreement is.
Okay. They are turning them over to Sea Share.
That's my understanding of what's going to happen this summer.
Okay. Well, we'll ask the Area M people that are going to be testifying next week to that point. Thank you for that. Do you see yourself being out there this summer any and really monitoring this kind of closely? I know you talked about it a little bit. We talked about a trip, but are you able to, if they are hitting the window, it will be shut down?
Well, there's triggers in here that result in actions regulatory wise, but if we were to get anywhere near what we had in the past, I would not hesitate to act to get this fishery back under some, keeping it around 500,000 chum salmon, knowing that 80% of those are a large proportion of those are Asian chum.
Thank you. Questions from committee members?
And that worked last year. I based with the cooperatives were formed largely because we told them that we were not interested in having another 1.1 million chum salmon harvested that year. So.
Thank you. It's any further questions from committee members today? We're about Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. You were saying the South Peninsula is mostly a sockeye fishery, and
in June,
and that's when the most chum are taken, it looks like, and then post June it doesn't look quite as much. But then what? I guess so. So the chum are all, they all go to this sea share type thing. I didn't see that. I know that they were coming. I think Trident was coming to talk about sea share yesterday, but I didn't see the presentation. Can you just explain exactly what that does?
So what chum are important to coastal Western Alaskan system. So one of the things they tried to do last year was take those chums that were delivered to the processing plant and give them the sea share so they could be redistributed to communities in the coastal Western Alaskan system. Now, we recognize that a frozen fish, a processed fish in the Area M fishery is not a replacement for catching those fish within the river. We understand that. But that was at least some way of returning some of those fish back. And some of those fish are, again, 6 out of 10 of those are probably going to be Asian chum that are going up there, not coastal Western Alaska, through that sea share program.
No further questions. Thank you, Commissioner.
And I want to thank you guys for the money that you're giving us in the future for these genetic studies. They're starting to piece the puzzles together as to what the composition of these stocks are and what we can do in terms of trying to minimize the harvest of them as we move them through. And you have our commitment to continue looking at the genetics piece so that we can start parsing out the Yukon and Cusco and Norton Sound stocks from that Coastal Western Alaskan group, because that's necessary as we move forward.
Okay. All right. Thank you. At this time, I'm going to take a brief at ease.
Back to order. Our next subject is Senate Bill 48. This is the Carbon Offset Program on State Land. It's a bill offered by the governor. So I will look to Senator Bishop for a motion.
I move to adopt CS for Senate Bill 48, Work Order 33-GS1372. /Bravo is our working document.
And I will object for purposes of discussion and invite my staff to the table to talk about the CS.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Julia O'Connor, staff to Senator Giesel. The committee substitute adopts the following changes. Technical and conforming drafting changes were made throughout the bill to conform to the legislative drafting manual, and the effective date was expanded to cover the entire bill. Page 9, line 17. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Julia. So essentially what this CS is taking the governor's bill and having our legislative legal drafting put it into our drafting format. So it's the same content, simply in our legislative drafting format. So the CS is now our working – I will remove my objection. Seeing no further objection, this is now our working document. So I had already set a previous amendment deadline, and we do have a few amendments to consider. We'll start with amendment number one. I move amendment number one. It is labeled 33GS1372/B Bravo 10.
And I'll object for the purpose of discussion.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Amendment number one is a combination of four amendments that were made in the other body, in the Resources Committee of the other body, as they went through the bill's process. Rena Miller is here today, and she can give us further details on this amended version. Essentially what those kinds of amendments were on the House side and their impact.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Giesel and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss amendment number one. For the record, I'm Rena Miller, Special Assistant in the Commissioner's Office at Department of Natural Resources. Amendment number one starts with, on page 3, line 30, adding receipt authority for the Division of Mining Land and Water for the leasing program. So this would enable the division, as income is generated through lease revenue, to use that revenue to supplant the general fund coverage of the position that we'd be looking for. The second part of the amendment, which is on amendment page 1, line 10, these are two findings in a BIF, a best interest finding, that were originally in the bill in relation to the state undertaking a state-led project under the new carbon offset program. The House Resources Committee felt that these were findings that would also be prudent to apply within the best interest finding required for a leasing program under the carbon offset bill. So to that end, on the bill, page 4, line 1, before entering into a land lease for the carbon management purpose, there needs to be a best interest finding, and then with this amendment, those findings have to consider reasonably foreseeable effects that the project will have on the state and local economy, and also the anticipated annual revenue that the lease would provide to the state. Further, state land used for those carbon management purposes under lease needs to remain open to the public for access, for hunting, for fishing, and other generally allowed uses as determined by the department. In this instance, those purposes must remain, to the extent practicable, what we're trying to do is acknowledge that not knowing what an individual may propose in a lease, there may be some minor aspect of site control somewhere within that lease area. And so that extent possible provides an opportunity for the division to balance the directive now with the amendment in the bill that land should be remain open with still allowing minor adjustments for site control to enable the leasing activity to take place at all.
Pause for one moment. Senator Kawasaki, a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question on what the term "to the extent practicable" means in the amended version.
Senator Kawasaki, thank you for the question. Through the chair, to the extent practicable is you're making this policy statement that it will remain open and then giving the division a bit of leeway there to the extent practicable so that the leasing activity can actually occur.
Further questions, Senator Kawasaki, did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Senator Bishop?
That's a favorite word in the department. Going back to the AGEA days, there's a lot of practicables in there.
Yes. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. So we've had on this, but on some other bills as well, I particularly remember with Cook Inlet gas issues, we've had some challenges with, you know, asking DNR a question that says that's a Department of Revenue issue. You ask Department of Revenue and they say it's actually a DNR issue. And so you talk about anticipated annual revenue the lease will yield to the state. Is it DNR that you think is going to be sort of figuring that out, or Department of Revenue? And then will that also take – my understanding is the way that it's written here, there are certain companies, frankly, oil companies – that could use some of their expenses here to write down some of their oil production taxes. And so is that calculated as part of the – is it, you know, net yield to the state, or just focused on this lease and you're ignoring the revenues you're going to lose somewhere else?
Senator Dunbar, thank you for the question. Through the chair, to the first question, who determines what that lease revenue to the state is? DNR is responsible for leasing state land and for negotiating the compensation to the state under that lease.
Okay.
To the second question, this is for the carbon management purpose that someone would be leasing the land for. I understand that there have been some questions from some committee members and potentially a future amendment that might address the prospect of someone seeking to take a cost associated with the carbon purpose and looking to use that as a lease expenditure to offset other tax liability. I think if you'd like, we can look to that potential amendment, or I'm not sure exactly how to answer your question from there.
Well, perhaps I'll repeat that question when that amendment comes forward.
Certainly, Senator Dunbar. And I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I don't want to leave it hanging. So 4355 is oil and gas production tax, and that would be very much administered by the Department of Revenue, right?
So the short answer is...
Happy to have them on the line for that conversation.
So the short answer then is DNR will produce this, and it will just be sort of what DNR is focused on. And the impacts that might happen in the DOR world won't be part of this calculation.
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, correct. DNR is not the compensation received for a lease related to carbon management purposes is under DNR's jurisdiction. Whatever an entity subject to the oil and gas production tax does in relation to filing those taxes, separate the oil and gas taxes, that is the Department of Revenue jurisdiction.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Miller, you do also have, looks like, about six people online if you want to refer to any of your lifelines.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions at this point? Okay, seeing none, I'll let you continue.
Thank you. Madam Chair, the amendment continues on line 21 of the amendment, which goes to page 8 of the bill. On page 8, line 22, on page 17, sorry. On page 8, line 17 of the bill, the management of state forests directive is amended so that state forests would need to be managed under the sustained yield principle, forestry chapters of statute, and a forest management plan. That's all existing statute. The bill would be adding a carbon offset project undertaken by the department. House Resources felt that it was important, and the department finds it helpful in clarity to add if applicable, so that if a carbon offset project is undertaken on that state forest, then that state forest would be managed under the sustained yield principle, statute, forest management plan, and that carbon offset project. Continuing with the amendment, page 9 of the bill, line 2. Right now, existing statute talks about forest management plans. To the extent that other activities are compatible with the primary purpose, other non-timber purposes like recreation and mining and wildlife and fish consumption can take place. Bringing carbon offset projects into the equation raises an interesting question, because a carbon offset project is in a way a timber purpose. And therefore, the recommendation was to delete the word non-timber on line 2 and just say for other purposes.
Senator Klayman.
Going back to the amendment on page 8, where you're adding in the if applicable language, there's 4 principles for managing state forests listed in there, including the sustained yield principle. How are those 4 different factors weighed amongst themselves? Is one higher priority, lower priority, or the equal priority? How do they weigh that?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, our state forester, Helge Eng, is, I believe, on the line and would be the best person to answer that question.
He is on the line. Director Eng, did you hear Senator Klayman's question? And if you did, could you identify yourself for the record and give us an answer?
Through the chair, Helge Eng, state forester. And the 4 criteria mentioned are equal in priority. There's no ranking implied.
Did that help, Senator Klayman?
Well, it answers the question. I find it interesting that the sustained yield principle, which I hear frequently referenced in how we manage our forests, that it's given equal weight of the other 3 factors is interesting.
Perhaps I can help with clarity on that.
Yes.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, given equal weight when you're undertaking management activities, but each is based off of the other to some degree. So the sustained yield concept is something that I believe our Constitution discusses, right? And then you have the statutes, this chapter, that of course reflect what's in the Constitution. And then the management plan is formed under statute. So there's a bit of a hierarchy in that context. But on a practical level, as the state forester said, you're managing under all of that cumulatively.
Follow up, Senator Klayman.
It just strikes me, if the Constitution requires sustained yield, that even though sustained yield may drive some of the other decisions, it seems to me if a conflict arose amongst these, it isn't done equally. It should be the sustained yield should be the greatest weight.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, assuming a conflict arises, that's I think if your forest management plan has to be compatible with statute, that has to be compatible with the Constitution. I think they're all tiered off of each other in that context. We do have also Chris Orman from Department of Law, who I think would confirm that, I mean, in any situation, the Constitution is the overriding law of the land.
Would you like to hear from Mr. Orman?
Please.
Mr. Orman, Assistant Attorney General, Natural Resources Section, did you hear Senator Klayman's question?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, Christopher Orman, Department of Natural Resources Section, Department of Law. I think the way Ms. Miller articulated it is probably the easiest way for me to think about it, to probably articulate it back to you, which is, yes, the sustained yield principle is a constitutional requirement. This chapter, which was referring to, you know, the provisions in 4117 pursuant to the state forest, is going to be driven by those constitutional provisions and the statutory provisions. A forest management plan is also going to be driven by that as well. And how a carbon offset project would be undertaken by the department in that context, if applicable, you know, meaning that they're actually being undertaken on those state forests, would also need to comply with those provisions. So In a sense, I think that everyone here has probably been right, which, boy, how lawyerly of me on a Friday afternoon. But, you know, I think when you look at it, the sustained yield principle is going to carry a lot of weight through that process in part and in that analysis, because it is part of those other provisions, you know, 2, 3, and 4 here that are being considered. Probably, I hope that answers the question. I think that you're correct as far as the sustained yield principle is constitutional and the weight that it's carrying, but then how it's kind of infused, if you will, into those other 4 provisions and considerations kind of, I think, shows and bolsters the weight of the sustained yield principle in that context.
Did that answer your question, Senator Clayman?
As best as he can.
It might be thought of as like yeast in a bread. It's infused throughout the substance.
That's the hope.
Just to relate to you and your bread making.
That's certainly the hope, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Clayman. Senator Kawasaki, did you have a question?
Okay. It was the same question.
All right, great. All right, anything else here? All right, anything else, Ms. Miller? Okay, yes, Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, Ms. Miller, through the chair. In all of this bill now with the CS and as amended by this amendment, can you go through where the requirements will be that we adequately survey to assure that we're not inadvertently trapping a more valuable resource? I've been puzzling over that in this whole construct, and I'd just like to hear a little bit about that now, you know, while you're here with us. Thank
you. Certainly, Senator Kaufman, through the chair. Think through how to phrase this. The department does not see a carbon offset project as choosing one resource over the other. Timber, for example, on a forest, harvest of that is compatible with a improved forest management carbon offset project. One resource that I think we've discussed and that is a little bit different is mineral resource and mining. And mining, of course, has a primacy to where we can't do a carbon offset project that would lock up land against mining unless there's a minerals closure. That's the only way to theoretically close off minerals. That's something that the legislature needs to approve to have happen. We don't foresee those being necessary in this process. What I'm trying to convey is that we never really get to choose to put anything else above that mineral estate. We think, however, that when we're contemplating where to do a project and what specific land area initially goes in a project, we have a good opportunity to avoid any future questions. And if there is a known near-term next step out of an existing mine, if there is a very highly prospective mineral resource that we know is potentially of interest to folks, it's not a hard thing to not enroll that specific area in part of that carbon offset project. Consideration should be given to those things. Part of the best interest finding that's required, of course, are impacts to the state and local economy. The department feels that encompasses this world of other resource development opportunities as well. And ultimately, if there's something we don't know today, can't know today, that comes up during the course of one of these 40-year commitments for a state project, there's an opportunity to still allow some surface disturbance for mining, for a road for a reason, whatever comes up, and still maintain our carbon offset project. The key will be being able to, every year, making sure that we are overall within that full project area, not dipping below the baseline carbon stock of the project, and always growing more than we harvest. And I say harvest, you can also interchange remove, for example, for a road, for example, for the surface impact of a subsurface mine. The larger the project, the easier it becomes to kind of accommodate those removals of carbon from your landscape. But there are ways to do that even within a smaller project that we feel really comfortable about, particularly looking to DNR's mandate to develop all resources for that benefit.
Follow up, Senator Kaufman.
Thank you.
Further questions? Are there other, no other discussion on amendment number one? Senator Bishop, do you remove your objection?
I do, Madam Chairman.
Are there further objections to amendment number one? All right, seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. So with that, I am aware that there are other amendments being refined and forthcoming. So we're going to continue this process. I'm going to set the bill aside right now. It will come up again. Perhaps you've noticed it will come up again next Wednesday. So at that time, we will continue to discuss amendments to it. So thank you for being here today. That concludes our agenda. Our next meeting will be Monday, May 1st at 3:30 p.m. On the agenda will be a continuation of today's Area M overview presentation with additional invited testimony. And the second item will be Senate Bill 68, Public Notice for Water Rights. So at this time, the meeting is adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 4:26 p.m.